Hello and welcome. I'm James Malacher, your host of An Angry Boomer's Take. With this episode, I'm going to explore my take as a boomer on current political events. I'm going to begin by sharing a very poignant essay I recently read in The Guardian. It is about the ramifications of the convergence of extreme Christian doctrine and extreme plutocracy. It is written by Naomi Klein and Astor Taylor and is titled, What They Want is Absolutely Everything. I'm going to follow the essay up with a few current event topics and questions posed to OpenAI with the voice of Eric. With no further ado, here is the essay. What they want is absolutely everything.
The movement for corporate city-states cannot believe its good luck. For years, it has been pushing the extreme notion that wealthy tax-averse people should up and start their own high-tech fiefdoms, whether new countries on artificial islands in international waters or pro-business freedom cities such as Prospera, which is a glorified gated community combined with a wild West Med spa on a Honduran island. Yet despite backing from the heavy-hitter venture capitalists Peter Thiel and Marc Andreessen, their extreme libertarian dreams kept bogging down. It turns out most self-respecting rich people don't actually want to live on floating oil rigs, even if it means lower taxes. And while Prospera might be nice for a holiday and some body upgrades, its extranational status is currently being challenged in court. Now, all of a sudden, this once-fringe network of corporate secessionists finds itself knocking on open doors at the dead center of global power. The first sign that fortunes were shifting came in 2023, when a campaigning Donald Trump, seemingly out of nowhere, promised to hold a contest that would lead to the creation of 10 freedom cities on federal lands. The trial balloon barely registered at the time, lost in the daily deluge of outrageous claims. Since the new administration took office, however, would-be country starters have been on a lobbying blitz determined to turn Trump's pledge into reality. The energy in D.C. is absolutely electric. Trey Goff, the chief of staff of Prospera, recently enthused after a trip to Capitol Hill. Legislation paving the way for a bevy of corporate city-states should be complete by the end of the year, he claims. Inspired by a warped reading of the political philosopher Albert Hirschman, figures including Goff, Thiel, and the investor and writer Balaji Srinivasan have been championing what they call exit, the principle that those with means have the right to walk away from the obligations of citizenship, especially taxes and burdensome regulation. Retooling and rebranding the old ambitions and privileges of empires, they dream of splintering governments and carving up the world into hyper-capitalist, democracy-free havens under the sole control of the supremely wealthy, protected by private mercenaries, serviced by AI robots, and financed by cryptocurrencies. One might assume that it is contradictory for Trump, elected on a flag-waving America First platform, to lend credence to this vision of sovereign territories ruled over by billionaire god kings. And much has been made of the colorful flame wars between the mega mouthpiece Steve Bannon, a proud nationalist and populist, and the Trump-allied billionaires he has attacked as techno-feudalists who don't give a flying fuck about the human being, let alone the nation-state, and conflicts inside Trump's awkward, jerry-rigged coalition certainly exist, most recently reaching a boiling point over tariffs. Still, the underlying visions might not be as incompatible as they first appear. The startup country contingent is clearly foreseeing a future marked by shocks, scarcity, and collapse. Their high-tech private domains are essentially fortressed escape pods, designed for the select few to take advantage of every possible luxury and opportunity for human optimization, giving them and their children an edge in an increasingly barbarous future. To put it bluntly, the most powerful people in the world are preparing for the end of the world, an end they themselves are frenetically accelerating. That is not so far away from the more mass-market vision of fortress nations that has gripped the hard right globally, from Italy to Israel, Australia to the United States. In a time of ceaseless peril, openly supremacist movements in these countries are positioning their relatively wealthy states as armed bunkers. These bunkers are brutal in their determination to expel and imprison unwanted humans, even if that requires indefinite confinement in extranational penal colonies from Manus Island to Guantanamo Bay, and equally ruthless in their willingness to violently claim the land and resources, water, energy, and critical minerals they deem necessary to weather the coming shocks. Interestingly, at a time when previously secular Silicon Valley elites are suddenly finding Jesus, it is noteworthy that both of these visions, the priority pass corporate state and the mass market bunker nation, share a great deal in common with the Christian fundamentalist interpretation of the biblical rapture, when the faithful will supposedly be lifted up to a golden city in heaven, while the damned are left to endure an apocalyptic final battle down here on earth. If we are to meet our critical moment in history, we need to reckon with the reality that we are not up against adversaries we have seen before. We are up against end times fascism. Reflecting on his childhood under Mussolini, the novelist and philosopher Umberto Eco observed in a celebrated essay that fascism typically has an Armageddon complex, a fixation on vanquishing enemies in a grand final battle. But European fascism of the 1930s and 1940s also had a horizon, a vision for a future golden age after the bloodbath that, for its in-group, would be peaceful, pastoral, and purified. Not today. Alive to our era of genuine existential danger, from climate breakdown to nuclear war, to skyrocketing inequality and unregulated AI, but financially and ideologically committed to deepening those threats, contemporary far-right movements lack any credible vision for a hopeful future. The average voter is offered only remixes of a bygone past, alongside the sadistic pleasures of dominance over an ever-expanding assemblage of dehumanized others. And so we have the Trump administration's dedication to releasing its steady stream of real and AI-generated propaganda designed solely for these pornographic purposes. Footage of shackled immigrants being loaded onto deportation flights set to the sounds of clanking chains and locking cuffs, which the official White House X account labeled ASMR, a reference to audio designed to calm the nervous system. Or the same account sharing news of the detention of Mahmoud Khalil, a U.S. permanent resident who was active in Columbia University's pro-Palestinian encampment, with the gloating words, "Shalom, Mahmoud." Or any number of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's sadism chic photo ops, atop a horse at the U.S.-Mexican border, in front of a crowded prison cell in El Salvador, slinging a machine gun while arresting immigrants in Arizona. The governing ideology of the far right in our age of escalating disasters has become a monstrous supremacist survivalism. It is terrifying in its wickedness, yes, but it also opens up powerful possibilities for resistance. To bet against the future on this scale, to bank on your bunker, is to betray, on the most basic level, our duties to one another, to the children we love, and to every other life form with whom we share a planetary home. This is a belief system that is genocidal at its core and treasonous to the wonder and beauty of this world. We are convinced that the more people understand the extent to which the right has succumbed to the Armageddon complex, the more they will be willing to fight back, realizing that absolutely everything is now on the line. Our opponents know full well that we are entering an age of emergency, but have responded by embracing lethal yet self-serving delusions. Having bought into various apartheid fantasies of bunkered safety, they are choosing to let the earth burn. Our task is to build a wide and deep movement, as spiritual as it is political, strong enough to stop these unhinged traitors. A movement rooted in a steadfast commitment to one another, across our many differences and divides, and to this miraculous, singular planet. Not so long ago, it was primarily religious fundamentalists who greeted signs of apocalypse with gleeful excitement about the long-awaited rapture. Trump has handed critical posts to people who subscribe to that fiery orthodoxy, including several Christian Zionists who see Israel's use of annihilatory violence to expand its territorial footprint not as illegal atrocities, but as felicitous evidence that the Holy Land is getting closer to the conditions under which the Messiah will return, and the faithful will get their celestial kingdom. Mike Huckabee, Trump's newly confirmed ambassador to Israel, has strong ties to Christian Zionism, as does Pete Hegseth, his Secretary of Defense. Noam and Russell Vaught, the Project 2025 architect who now leads the Office of Budget and Management, are both staunch advocates for Christian nationalism. Even Thiel, who is gay and notorious for his party lifestyle, has been heard musing about the arrival of the Antichrist of late. Spoiler. He thinks it's Greta Thunberg. More on that soon. But you don't need to be a biblical literalist or even religious to be an end times fascist. Today, plenty of powerful secular people have embraced a vision of the future that follows a nearly identical script, one in which the world as we know it collapses under its weight and a chosen few survive and thrive in various kinds of arcs, bunkers, and gated freedom cities. In a 2019 paper titled Left Behind, Future Fetishists, Prepping, and the Abandonment of Earth, the communication scholars Sarah T. Roberts and Mel Hogan described the longing for a secular rapture. In the accelerationist imaginary, the future is not about harm reduction, limits, or restoration. Rather, it is a politics driving toward an endgame. Elon Musk, who dramatically grew his fortune alongside Thiel at PayPal, embodies this implosive ethos. This is a person who looks up at the wonders of the night sky and apparently sees only opportunities to fill that inky unknown with his own space junk. Though he burnished his reputation warning about the dangers of the climate crisis and AI, he and his so-called Department of Government Efficiency henchmen now spend their days escalating those same risks and many others by slashing not only environmental regulations, but entire regulatory agencies, with the apparent end goal of replacing federal workers with chatbots. Who needs a functioning nation state when outer space beckons? Now, reportedly Musk's singular obsession. For Musk, Mars has become a secular arc, which he claims is key to the survival of human civilization, perhaps via uploaded consciousnesses to an artificial general intelligence. Kim Stanley Robinson, the author of the sci-fi Mars trilogy that appears to have partially inspired Musk, is blunt about the dangers of the billionaire's fantasies about colonizing Mars. It is, he says, just a moral hazard that creates the illusion we can wreck Earth and still be okay. It's totally not true. Much like religious end-timers who long to escape the corporeal realm, Musk's drive for humanity to become multiplanetary is made possible by his inability to appreciate the multi-species splendor of our only home. Evidently uninterested in the vast bounty that surrounds him, or in ensuring Earth can continue buzzing with diversity, he instead deploys his vast fortune to bring about a future that would see a handful of people and robots eke out survival on two barren orbs, a radically depleted Earth and a terraformed Mars. Indeed, in a strange twist on the Old Testament tale, Musk and his fellow tech billionaires, having arrogated godlike powers to themselves, aren't content to just build the arcs. They appear to be doing their best to cause the flood. Today's right-wing leaders and their rich allies are not just taking advantage of catastrophes, shock doctrine, and disaster capitalism style, but simultaneously provoking and planning for them. What of the MAGA base, though? Not all are sufficiently faithful to earnestly believe in the rapture, and most certainly don't have the cash to buy a spot in a freedom city, let alone on a rocket ship. Fear not. End times fascism offers the promise of many more affordable arcs and bunkers, these ones well within reach for lower-level foot soldiers. Listen to Steve Bannon's Daily Podcast, which bills itself as MAGA's premier media outlet, and you will be barraged with a singular message. The world is going to hell, the infidels are breaching the barricades, and a final battle is coming. Be prepared. The prepper message becomes particularly pronounced when Bannon switches to hawking his advertisers' products. By Birch Gold, Bannon tells his audience, because the overleveraged U.S. economy is going to crash, and you can't trust the banks. Stock up on ready-to-eat meals from my Patriot Supply. Sharpen your target practice using a laser-guided at-home system. The last thing you would want to do is depend on the government during a disaster, he reminds listeners left unsaid, especially now that the Doge boys are selling off the government for parts. Bannon doesn't only urge his audience to make their own bunkers, of course. He also advances a vision of the United States as a bunker in its own right, one in which ICE agents stalk the streets, workplaces, and campuses, disappearing those deemed enemies of U.S. policy and interests. The bunkered nation lies at the heart of the MAGA agenda and of end-times fascism. Inside its logic, the first job is to harden national borders and expunge all enemies, foreign and domestic. This ugly work is now well underway, with the Trump administration, enabled by the Supreme Court, having invoked the Alien Enemies Act to deport hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants to Secote, the now infamous megaprison in El Salvador. The facility, which shaves prisoners' heads and packs up to 100 people into a single cell stacked with bare bunks, operates under the civil liberties-destroying state of exception, first declared over 3 years ago by the country's crypto-loving Christian Zionist Prime Minister, Nayib Bukele. Bukele has offered to provide the same fee-for-service system for U.S. citizens the administration would like to drop into a judicial black hole. "I love that," Trump said recently when asked about the proposal. No wonder. Secote is the sick, if logical, corollary of the Freedom City fantasy, a zone where everything is for sale and due process does not apply. We should expect much more of this sadism. In a chillingly candid statement, the acting ICE director, Todd Lyons, told the 2025 Border Security Expo that he wanted to see a more business-oriented approach to these deportations, like Amazon Prime, but with human beings. If policing the boundaries of the bunkered nation is end times fascism's job one, equally important is job two, for the U.S. government to lay claim to whatever resources its protected citizens might need to get through the tough times ahead. Maybe it's Panama's canal, or Greenland's fast-melting shipping routes, or Ukraine's critical minerals, or Canada's fresh water. We should think of this less as old-school imperialism than supersized prepping at the level of the national state. Gone are the old colonial fig leaves of spreading democracy or God's word. When Trump covetously scans the globe, he is stockpiling for civilizational collapse. This bunker mentality also helps explain J.D. Vance's controversial forays into Catholic theology. The vice president, who owes his political career in no small part to the largest of the premier prepper teal, explained to Fox News that, according to the medieval Christian concept of Ordo Amoris, translated both as order of love and order of charity, love is not owed to those outside the bunker. You love your family, and then you love your neighbor, and then you love your community, and then you love your fellow citizens in your own country. And then after that, you can focus and prioritize the rest of the world. Or not, as the Trump administration's foreign policy would indicate. In other words, we owe nothing to anyone outside our bunker, though it builds on enduring right-wing tendencies. Justifying hateful exclusions is hardly new under the ethno-nationalist sun. We simply have not faced such a powerful apocalyptic strain in government before. The end of history, swagger of the post-Cold War era, is rapidly being supplanted by a conviction we are in the actual end of times. Doge may wrap itself in the banner of economic efficiency, and Musk's underlings may evoke memories of the young, U.S.-trained Chicago boys who designed the economic shock therapy for Augusto Pinochet's dictatorial regime. But this is not simply the old marriage of neoliberalism and neoconservatism. It's a new, money-worshipping millenarian mashup that says we need to smash the bureaucracy and replace humans with chatbots in order to cut waste, fraud, and abuse, and also because the bureaucracy is where the Trump-resisting demons hide. This is where the tech bros merge with the Theo brothers, a real group of hyper-patriarchal Christian supremacists with ties to Hegseth and others, as fascism always does. Today's Armageddon complex crosses class lines, bonding billionaires to the mega base. Thanks to decades of deepening economic stresses, alongside ceaseless and skillful messaging pitting workers against one another, a great many people understandably feel unable to protect themselves from the disintegration that surrounds them, no matter how many months of ready-to-eat meals they buy. But there are emotional compensations on offer. You can cheer the end of affirmative action and DEI, glorify mass deportation, enjoy the denial of gender-affirming care to trans people, villainize educators and health workers who think they know better than you, and applaud the demise of economic and environmental regulations as a way to own the libs. End times fascism is a darkly festive fatalism, a final refuge for those who find it easier to celebrate destruction than imagine living without supremacy. It's also a self-reinforcing downward spiral. Trump's furious attacks on every structure designed to protect the public from diseases, dangerous foods, and disasters, even to tell the public when disasters are headed their way, strengthen the case for preparism at both the high and low ends, all while creating myriad new opportunities for privatization and profiteering by the oligarchs powering this rapid-fire unmaking of the social and regulatory state. At the dawn of Trump's first term, The New Yorker investigated a phenomenon that it described as doomsday prep for the super rich. Back then, it was already clear that in Silicon Valley and on Wall Street, the more serious high-end survivalists were hedging against climate disruption and social collapse by buying space in custom-built underground bunkers and building escape homes on high ground in places like Hawaii, where Mark Zuckerberg has downplayed his 5,000-square-foot underground pad as a little shelter, and New Zealand, where Thiel purchased nearly 500 acres but found his plan to build a luxury survivalist compound, rejected by local authorities in 2022 for being an eyesore. This millenarianism is bound up with a suite of other Silicon Valley intellectual fads, all premised on an end-times-inflected belief that our planet is headed towards a cataclysm, and it's time to make some hard choices about which parts of humanity can be saved. Transhumanism is one such ideology, encompassing everything from minor human-machine enhancements to the quest to upload human intelligence into a still illusory artificial general intelligence. There is also effective altruism and long-termism, both of which skip over redistributive approaches to helping those in need in the here and now in favor of a cost-benefit approach to doing the most good in the long term. Though they can appear benign at first glance, these ideas are shot through with dangerous racial, ableist, and gender biases about which parts of humanity are worth enhancing and saving, and which could be sacrificed for the supposed good of the whole. They also share a marked lack of interest in urgently addressing the underlying drivers of collapse, a responsible and rational goal that a growing cohort of figures now actively shun. Instead of effective altruism, the Mar-a-Lago regular Andreessen and others have embraced effective accelerationism, or the deliberate propulsion of technological development without guardrails. Meanwhile, even darker philosophies are finding a wider audience, like the neo-reactionary pro-monarchy rants of the coder Curtis Yarvin, another one of Till's intellectual touchstones, or the pronatalism movement's obsession with dramatically increasing the number of Western babies, a Musk fixation, as well as the exit guru Srinivasan's vision of a tech Zionist. San Francisco, where corporate loyalists and police join forces to politically cleanse the city of liberals to make way for their networked apartheid state. As the AI scholars Timnit Gebru and Emil P. Torres have written, though the methods may be new, this bundle of ideological fads are direct descendants of first-wave eugenics, which also saw a small subset of humanity making decisions about which parts of the whole were worth continuing and which needed to be phased out, cleared out, or terminated. Until recently, few paid attention. Much like Prospera, where members can already experiment with human-machine mergers such as having their Tesla keys implanted into their hands, these intellectual fads seem to be the marginal hobby horses of a few Bay Area dilettantes with money and caution to burn. No longer. Three recent material developments have accelerated end times fascism's apocalyptic appeal. The first is the climate crisis. While some high-profile figures might still publicly deny or minimize the threat, global elites, whose oceanfront properties and data centers are intensely vulnerable to rising temperatures and sea levels, are well-versed in the ramifying perils of an ever-heating world. The second is COVID-19, Epidemiological models had long predicted the possibility of a pandemic devastating our globally networked world. The actual arrival of one was taken by many powerful people as a sign that we have officially arrived at what U.S. military analysts forecasted as the age of consequences. No more predictions, it's going down. The third factor is the rapid advancement and adoption of AI, a set of technologies that have long been associated with sci-fi terrors about machines turning on their makers with ruthless efficiency, fears expressed most forcefully by the same people who are developing these technologies. All of these existential crises are layered on top of escalating tensions between nuclear-armed powers. None of this should be written off as paranoia. Many of us feel the imminence of breakdown so acutely that we cope by entertaining ourselves with various versions of life in a post-apocalyptic bunker, streaming Apple's Silo or Hulu's paradise. As the UK analyst and editor Richard Seymour reminds us in his recent book, Disaster Nationalism, the apocalypse is no mere fantasy. We are living in it, after all, from deadly viruses to soil erosion, from economic crisis to geopolitical chaos. Trump 2.0's economic project is a Frankenstein's monster of the industries driving all of these threats: fossil fuels, weapons and resource-ravenous cryptocurrency, and AI. Everyone involved in these sectors knows that there is no way to build the artificial mirror world that AI promises to construct without sacrificing this world. These technologies consume too much energy, too many critical minerals, and too much water for the two to coexist in any kind of equilibrium. This month, the former Google executive Eric Schmidt admitted as much, telling Congress that AI's profound energy needs are projected to triple in the next few years, with much of it coming from fossil fuels, because nuclear can't come online fast enough. This planet-incinerating level of consumption is necessary, he explained, to enable an intelligence higher than humanity, a digital god rising from the ashes of our relinquished world. And they are worried, just not about the actual threats they are unleashing. What keeps the leaders of these entangled industries up at night is the prospect of a civilizational wake-up call, of serious, internationally coordinated government efforts to rein in their rogue sectors before it's too late. From the perspective of their ever-expanding bottom lines, the apocalypse is not collapse, it's regulation. The fact that their profits are predicated on planetary devastation helps explain why do-gooder discourse among the powerful is giving way to open expressions of disdain for the idea that we owe each other anything by right of our shared humanity. Silicon Valley is done with altruism, effective or otherwise. Meta's Mark Zuckerberg pines for a culture that celebrates aggression. Alex Karp, Till's business partner at the surveillance firm Palantir Technologies, rebukes the losing self-flagellation of those who question American superiority and the benefits of autonomous weapons systems, and by association, the lucrative military contracts that have made Karp's vast fortune. Musk informs Joe Rogan that empathy is the fundamental weakness of Western civilization, and he vents after failing to purchase a Supreme Court election in Wisconsin. It increasingly appears that humanity is a biological bootloader for digital superintelligence, meaning we humans are nothing but grist for Grok, the AI service he owns. He did tell us he was Dark Mega, and he's not the only one. In arid and climate-stressed Spain, one of the groups calling for a moratorium on new data centers calls itself Two Noob Sica Mi Rio, Spanish for "Your cloud is drying my river." The name is fitting, and not just for Spain. An unspeakably dismal choice is being made before our eyes and without our consent. Machines over humans, inanimate over animate, profits over all else. With stunning speed, the big tech megalomaniacs have quietly rolled back their net zero pledges and lined up by Trump's side, hell-bent on sacrificing this world's real and precious resources and creativity at the altar of a vampiric virtual realm. This is the last great heist, and they are getting ready to ride out the storms they themselves are summoning, and they will try to defame and destroy anyone who gets in their way. Consider Vance's recent European sojourn, where the vice president harangued world leaders for hand-wringing about safety in relation to job-destroying AI while demanding Nazi and fascist speech go uncurtailed online. At one point, he made a telling aside, expecting a laugh that never came. If American democracy can survive 10 years of Greta Thunberg scolding, you guys can survive a few months of Elon Musk. His comment echoed those made by his equally humorless patron Thiel. In recent interviews focused on the theological underpinnings of his far-right politics, the Christian billionaire has repeatedly compared the indefatigable young climate activist to the Antichrist, a figure he warns was prophesied to come bearing a misleading message of peace and safety. If Greta gets everyone on the planet to ride a bicycle, maybe that's a way to solve climate change, but it has sort of this quality of going from the frying pan into the fire, Thiel intoned. Why Thunberg? Why now? In part, it's clearly the apocalyptic fear of regulation eating into their super profits, according to Thiel, the science-based climate action Thunberg, and others' demand could only be enforced by a totalitarian state, which he claims is more dire a threat than climate breakdown. Most distressingly, the taxes under such conditions would be quite high. There may also be something else about Thunberg that frightens them. Her steadfast commitment to this planet and the many life forms who call it home, not to simulations of this world generated by AI or to a hierarchy of those deserving of life and those who are not, nor to any of the various extraplanetary escape fantasies the end times fascists are selling. She is committed to staying while the end times fascists have, at least in their imaginings, already left this realm, ensconced in their opulent shelters or transcended to the digital ether, or to Mars. Shortly after Trump's re-election, one of us had the opportunity to interview Anoni, one of the few musicians who have attempted to make art that wraps its arms around the death drive that has gripped our world. Asked about what connects the willingness of powerful people to let the planet burn and the drive to deny bodily autonomy to women and to trans people like her, she responded by drawing on her Irish Catholic upbringing. It's a very long-held myth that we are enacting and embodying. This is the culmination of their rapture. This is their escape from the voluptuous cycle of creation. This is their escape from Mother. How do we break this apocalyptic fever? First, we help each other face the depth of the depravity that has gripped the hard right in all of our countries to move forward with focus. We must first understand this simple fact. We are up against an ideology that has given up not only on the premise and promise of liberal democracy, but on the livability of our shared world, on its beauty, on its people, on our children, and on other species. The forces we are up against have made peace with mass death. They are treasonous to this world and its human and non-human inhabitants. Second, we counter their apocalyptic narratives with a far better story about how to survive the hard times ahead without leaving anyone behind. A story capable of draining end times fascism of its gothic power and galvanizing a movement ready to put it all on the line for our collective survival. A story not of end times, but of better times. Not of separation and supremacy, but of interdependence and belonging. Not of escaping, but staying put and staying faithful to the troubled earthly reality in which we are enmeshed and bound. This basic sentiment, of course, is not new. It is central to indigenous cosmologies, and it lies at the heart of animism. Go back far enough, and every culture and faith has its own tradition of respecting the sanctity of here, and not searching for Zion in an elusive, ever-distant promised land. In Eastern Europe, before the fascist and Stalinist annihilations, the Jewish Socialist Labor Bund organized around the Yiddish concept of Doykeit, or Here-ness. Molly Crabapple, who has written a forthcoming book about this neglected history, defines Doykeit as the right to fight for freedom and safety in the places where they lived in defiance of everyone who wanted them dead, and rather than be forced to flee to safety in Palestine or the United States. Perhaps what is needed is a modern-day universalization of that concept, a commitment to the right to the here-ness of this particular ailing planet, to these frail bodies, to the right to live in dignity wherever on the planet we are, even when the inevitable shocks forces us to move. Hearness can be portable, free of nationalism, rooted in solidarity, respectful of Indigenous rights, and unbounded by borders. That future would require its own apocalypse, its own world ending and revelation, though of a very different sort. Because as the scholar of policing Robin Maynard has observed, in order to make earthly planetary survival possible, some versions of this world need to end. We have reached a choice point, not about whether we are facing apocalypse, but what form it will take. The activist sisters Adrienne Marie and Autumn Brown touched on this recently on their aptly named podcast, How to Survive the End of the World. In this moment, when end times fascism is waging war on every front, new alliances are essential. But instead of asking, do we all share the same worldview? Adrienne urges us to ask, is your heart beating and do you plan to live? Then come this way, and we will figure out the rest on the other side. To have a hope of combating the end times fascists with their ever-constricting and asphyxiating concentric circles of ordered love, we will need to build an unruly open-hearted movement of the earth-loving faithful, faithful to this planet, its people, its creatures, and to the possibility of a livable future for us all.
Now I'm going to continue, and I'm going to move on to a few articles that I read concerning the El Salvadorian president, Nayib Bukele. And I'm going to pose a few questions to Eric, our AI voice this week. Hello, Eric.
Hello, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Did the El Salvadorian president, Bukele, cut deals with gangs in El Salvador to gain political power?
Yes, substantial evidence suggests that President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador engaged in secret negotiations with criminal gangs, particularly MS-13 and Barrio 18, to bolster his political ascent. Investigative reports, notably from the Salvadoran outlet El Faro, allege that Bukele's administration negotiated with gang leaders to reduce homicide rates and secure electoral support for his party Nuevas Ideas during the 2021 legislative elections. In exchange, gangs reportedly received improved prison conditions and other concessions. These claims were substantiated by the U.S. Department of the Treasury in December 2021, which sanctioned two Salvadoran officials, Osiris Luna Meza and Carlos Marroquin Chica, for their roles in these clandestine dealings. The Treasury asserted that the Bukele administration provided financial incentives to gangs to lower homicide rates and gain political backing. Further corroboration comes from gang leaders themselves. Carlos Cartagena Lopez, known as Charlie de Ivu of Barrio 18, claimed in interviews that negotiations with Bukele's team began as early as 2014 to aid his political ambitions. He identified Carlos Marroquin as a key intermediary facilitating these agreements. The alleged truce unraveled in March 2022 following a surge of 87 homicides over a single weekend. This spike in violence was reportedly a response to the government's perceived betrayal of the pact. Subsequently, Bukele's administration initiated a widespread crackdown, resulting in over 85,000 arrests under a state of emergency. President Bukele has consistently denied these allegations, dismissing them as politically motivated attacks. Nonetheless, his administration has faced criticism for undermining democratic institutions, suppressing dissent, and compromising the rule of law. In summary, multiple sources, including investigative journalism and U.S. government findings, indicate that Bukele's rise to power was facilitated by covert agreements with criminal gangs, casting a shadow over his administration's legitimacy and commitment to democratic principles.
Eric, I've read a few stories alleging that Bukele instructed the gangs to dispose of bodies of murder victims in the once murder capital of the world, where it became no bodies, therefore no murders. Can you elaborate on this?
Yes, credible reports suggest that under President Nayib Bukele, El Salvador's government engaged in covert agreements with gangs like MS-13 and Barrio 18 to reduce visible homicides, allegedly by instructing them to conceal bodies, effectively lowering the official murder count. Investigations indicate that Bukele's administration negotiated with gang leaders to decrease homicide rates and garner electoral support. In return, gangs reportedly received concessions such as improved prison conditions and reduced sentences. As part of these agreements, gangs were allegedly instructed to hide bodies to reduce the number of recorded murders. There are many discrepancies in homicide statistics. While official data shows a significant drop in homicides from 1,147 in 2021 to 496 in 2022, analysts and NGOs have raised concerns about the accuracy of these figures. Investigations suggest that homicides may have been undercounted by nearly 27% since 2021, with some estimates indicating a 47% undercount in 2023. Concurrently, there has been a notable rise in disappearances. Reports indicate that over the past year, 366 individuals have gone missing, averaging one disappearance per day. This trend raises concerns that some homicides are being reclassified or unreported. However, the concurrent rise in disappearances and allegations of data manipulation suggest that the true level of violence may be obscured, raising questions about the transparency and ethics of the government's approach to crime reduction.
I heard Bukali is now targeting the journalist who exposed his relationship with the gangs. He is seeking to arrest and imprison investigative journalists, calling for sentences up to 20 years. Can you elaborate on this, Eric?
Yes, credible reports indicate that President Nayib Bukele's administration in El Salvador is intensifying its crackdown on independent journalism, particularly targeting investigative reporters who have exposed alleged government negotiations with criminal gangs. This campaign includes the preparation of arrest warrants and the potential imposition of lengthy prison sentences. On May 5, 2025, the investigative news outlet El Faro reported that at least seven of its staff members are facing possible arrest warrants. The charges reportedly include apology for crimes and illicit association, despite long-standing legal protections for journalist source confidentiality in El Salvador. In April 2022, El Salvador's Congress passed a law authorizing prison sentences of 10 to 15 years for media outlets that reproduce or disseminate messages from gangs, prompting accusations of censorship from press freedom groups. Investigations have revealed that journalists, particularly those from El Faro, have been subjected to surveillance using Pegasus spyware. Between July 2020 and November 2021, 22 El Faro journalists were reportedly targeted. Human rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Reporters Without Borders, have condemned these actions, highlighting the erosion of press freedom and democratic norms in El Salvador. The U.S. Department of State has also expressed concerns over the deteriorating human rights situation in the country. These developments underscore a troubling trend of authoritarianism and suppression of dissent in El Salvador, raising alarms about the future of independent journalism and democratic governance in the region.
The political scene in El Salvador today could quite possibly be one of the outcomes of the Trump administration's overall goals. Would you agree with this assessment?
The trajectory of El Salvador under President Nayib Bukele has raised concerns among observers who see parallels with the goals and strategies of the Trump administration, particularly regarding democratic norms, immigration policies, and the consolidation of executive power. Since taking office, Bukele has taken steps that many view as undermining democratic institutions. In 2021, his party's supermajority in the Legislative Assembly led to the removal of the constitutional court judges and the attorney general, actions widely condemned as a self-coup and a significant blow to judicial independence. Such moves have effectively dismantled checks and balances, allowing for greater executive control. Similarly, President Donald Trump has been criticized for actions perceived as attempts to erode democratic norms, including challenging the independence of the judiciary and the press. Both leaders have employed rhetoric that delegitimizes opposition and concentrates power within the executive branch. The Trump administration's immigration policies have faced scrutiny for their aggressive stance, including mass deportations and the use of executive orders to bypass traditional legislative processes. Notably, the administration deported individuals to El Salvador, where they were detained in facilities like the Terrorism Confinement Center, raising human rights concerns. Bukele's government has been cooperative in accepting deportees, including those sent under controversial circumstances. This collaboration has been viewed by some as enabling the U.S. administration's hardline immigration policies while also aligning with Bukele's domestic agenda of strict security measures. Both administrations have been accused of suppressing dissent and undermining media freedom. In the United States, the Trump administration's contentious relationship with the media, including labeling certain outlets as fake news, has been seen as an attempt to delegitimize critical reporting and erode public trust in the press. In conclusion, the developments in El Salvador under President Bukele reflect a broader trend of democratic erosion that some fear could be mirrored in the United States under similar leadership. The parallels in undermining institutional checks, aggressive immigration policies, and suppression of dissent highlight the importance of vigilance in protecting democratic norms and human rights.
The Trump administration is using the unitary executive theory to grasp unprecedented presidential power. Could you explain the theory and its constitutional basis?
The unitary executive theory is a legal and constitutional doctrine that asserts that all executive power must be held by and under the control of the President of the United States. In its strongest form, the theory argues that the President has broad, sometimes unchecked, authority to control the entire executive branch, even over agencies that are designed to be independent. The unitary executive theory is rooted in Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution, which begins, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America." Proponents interpret this vesting clause as giving the president exclusive control over the executive branch, meaning the president can direct or remove executive officers at will. Independent agencies like the SEC or FTC are constitutionally dubious if they operate without full presidential oversight. Congress cannot create executive structures that shield officers from presidential control. Federalist No. 70 by Alexander Hamilton supports a strong, singular executive as essential for accountability and effective governance. Supreme Court cases have both reinforced and limited the theory. Myers v. United States, 1926, affirmed the president's removal power over executive officers. Humphrey's Executor v. United States, 1935, limited this by allowing Congress to create independent regulatory agencies. Presidents including Reagan, Bush, and Trump have cited the theory to justify signing statements that ignore or reinterpret parts of laws, argue that investigations into the executive branch must be under presidential control, expand the use of executive orders, often bypassing Congress. Critics argue the theory concentrates too much power in the presidency, undermining checks and balances, erodes congressional authority and the independence of key institutions, paves the way for authoritarianism, particularly when paired with political loyalty tests for executive officials.
The U.S. Constitution also vests power to the legislative and judicial branches of government using the same language power shall be vested in. Doesn't that serve to discredit the unitary executive theory of the president having supreme power? Because the proponents of the unitary executive theory are basing the whole theory on the wording, "the executive power shall be vested in the president," used in Article 2?
Yes, on its face, the U.S. Constitution structure directly challenges the strongest versions of the unitary executive theory, particularly the idea that the president holds supreme or exclusive power over all government functions. Let's break it down. The U.S. Constitution explicitly divides power. Article 1 vests legislative power in Congress. Article 3 vests judicial power in the courts. Article 2 vests only executive power in the president. This division was intentional to prevent consolidation of power, which the founders saw as a threat to liberty. It contradicts any claim that the president alone has supreme power over the entire government. The unitary executive theory, in its strongest form, argues that all executive branch functions and actors, even independent agencies, must be under the direct control of the president. In its extreme form, it has been used to justify near-monarch-type powers, like the firing any official at will, ignoring congressional oversight, or asserting immunity from prosecution or subpoena. But this strong version conflicts with checks and balances such as congressional investigations and budget control, judicial review such as courts striking down executive actions, and Senate confirmation and impeachment powers. There is also legal and historical pushback to consider. Youngstown Sheet and Tubers. Sawyer, in 1952, is the landmark case where the Supreme Court said President Truman could not seize private industry without congressional approval, even during war. Justice Jackson's concurrence laid out a tripartite framework showing the president's power is strongest with congressional support and weakest when acting against it. This remains a key limit on any supreme executive power claim. In conclusion, the Constitution's separation of powers does not support the idea that the president is the supreme authority over the entire government. The unitary executive theory, in its narrowest form, that one person controls the executive, is constitutionally plausible. But in its broadest absolutist form, it fundamentally conflicts with the Constitution's design.
Project 2025 utilizes the unitary executive theory as the basis for its proposed actions. While Donald Trump denied knowing about Project 2025 and made statements he was not going to use it while he was on the campaign trail, he seems to be following Project 2025 to a T. In fact, he's achieving their initiatives faster than the plan architect had hoped for. What are your thoughts on this, Eric?
You are correct in observing that President Donald Trump's actions during his second term closely align with the objectives outlined in Project 2025, a comprehensive policy blueprint developed by the Heritage Foundation and other conservative think tanks. Despite publicly distancing himself from the project during his campaign, stating, "I have nothing to do with Project 2025, his administration's initiatives mirror many of its recommendations. This is how Project 2025 utilizes the unitary executive theory. First, presidential control over the bureaucracy. Project 2025 proposes to purge tens of thousands of career civil servants and replace them with loyal political appointees. Abolish or neuter independent agencies, for example, the FTC, the Fed, and the FCC, placing them under direct presidential control. Eliminate employment protections under Schedule F, allowing the president to fire civil servants at will. This directly applies the unitary executive idea that the president should have unfettered authority over all executive branch personnel. Second, politicizing the Justice Department. The plan calls for turning DOJ and FBI into instruments of presidential will rather than semi-independent law enforcement bodies. Installing officials who will prosecute ideological enemies and shield allies, undermining the traditional apolitical stance of federal law enforcement. Third, defying congressional oversight. Project 2025 encourages the executive to ignore or minimize compliance with congressional subpoenas and investigations. Assert executive privilege expansively, even over routine matters. This sidelines the legislative branch, violating the separation of powers doctrine, but fits within a radicalized interpretation of the unitary executive theory. Fourth, restructuring government agencies. WOSIs, like the EPA, Education Department, and HHS, would be repurposed or gutted. Policies regarding climate change, civil rights, LGBTQ+ protections, and reproductive rights would be reversed or defunded by executive action alone. How the Trump administration aligns with Project 2025. Project 2025 advocates for a significant expansion of presidential power, leveraging the unitary executive theory to centralize authority within the executive branch. Key aspects of this alignment include executive overreach. The administration has implemented policies that consolidate power within the presidency, often bypassing traditional checks and balances. Civil service overhaul, efforts to reclassify federal employees, making it easier to replace them with political appointees, reflect Project 2025's goal of reshaping the federal workforce to align with the president's agenda. Regulatory rollbacks. The administration has aggressively pursued deregulation across various sectors, consistent with the project's emphasis on reducing federal oversight. Observers have noted that the pace at which these policies are being enacted surpasses expectations. For instance, Vice President J.D. Vance highlighted achievements in immigration policy and energy deregulation within the first 100 days. Additionally, the administration's swift action on tariffs and workforce reductions aligns with the project's objectives. While the administration touts these actions as fulfilling campaign promises, critics argue that they undermine democratic institutions and erode civil liberties. Public opinion reflects a nation divided, with concerns about authoritarianism and the dismantling of established norms. In summary, despite President Trump's public disavowal of Project 2025, on the campaign trail, his administration's policies and actions closely follow its blueprint, raising questions about transparency and the future of democratic governance in the United States.
Thank you, Eric, for your insight. Being firmly entrenched in the mechanizations of Project 2025, what are our recourses? While Trump thinks the Supreme Court is making a few decisions in his favor, they are merely punting the cases back down to the lower courts. They may have lifted a few lower court injunctions, but by and large have not made final decisions on almost all the Trump administration overreach cases put forth before them. It's almost as if Roberts is trying to ride it out until the midterm elections to actually hear the cases in full and make final rulings. I personally think he feels SCOTUS' final decisions would sway the midterm elections one way or the other, so he's taking the coward's way out by punting until then. We have a few recourses to resist, but the most powerful resistance machine, the Democratic Party, is far from being a leader in a resistance movement. There are very few individual Democratic representative and party voices leading the resistance. The party itself is way too invested in fundraising and utilizing poll data than actually engaging in unified resistance. Here's a message I have for the Democratic Party leadership. Screw your fundraising and kowtowing to the rich elite in corporate America. Start listening to actual people, face to face, because I'm quite sure you'll hear the same message repeated over and over again. We're mad as hell and we're not going to take this shit anymore. Democratic Party leaders, start listening and act now, as some of the ire of that statement refers to you as well as the MAGA movement. If you, the Democratic Party, don't take the reins now, you'll no longer have a horse left to ride, as your horse will surely morph into a hearse, taking you off into the sunset. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, would like to be a guest, contribute a poem, a song, and or have comments about this and past episodes, please contact me at angryboomerjim@gmail.com. Once again, it is all one word, angryboomerjim@gmail.com. I would like to conclude this episode with a poem I wrote titled Changing Times. Thank you.
Changing Times. Executive orders overwhelming each and every day. I just cannot keep up. Ugly fascism creeping this way. Will this nightmare come to an end? An answer no one surely knows, with a wannabe king wearing absolutely no clothes. Most pretend not to notice. They just cannot see. Blinded by political theater, fueled by meanness and cruelty. An ideology burrowing deep into the most basic of feelings, to the dark infinite depths, where fear and hatred are reeling. Order, structure, blind obedience, such a world they yearn. Pickup trucks with flags a-flowing. True love of country, will they ever learn? A country is more than a warped ideology wafting through the air. It is land, people, real human beings, deserving respect, deserving care. On board a hard-charging Amtrak, armed to a T, shouting back and forth, your papers, give them to me. Chamber echoed a threat to our ways, bottom rungs of the ladder kept so low. Captured by force, shackled and hooded, even if legal, still forced to go. Sent off in the dead of night, grieving families torn. Some to prisons in countries where torture is the norm. How far have we gone? How far will we go? Where once there was hope, I no longer know. Empathy, forgiveness, and compassion, at one time they rang. Times there are changing, Dylan once sang. But now, it's just not the same, no longer from darkness into the light. More like a lost soul, slowly losing all sight. Old laws circumvented, loopholes at their core. We once were civilized, but we are no longer more. Some claim we're winning, shouting with glee. But what have we won? Painful loss and misery is all I see. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to be free.